Hi folks, before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with our guest Andrew McMillan, all about the world's worst exercise. A happy new year for me. This is the first one of these I've done since we turned 2024. Well done folks, another year older, another year wiser, question mark. This is a great episode, really enjoyed talking to Andrew, fantastic poet, one of my favourite living poets. Yep, definitely still alive as of time of recording. And I really heartily recommend his collections and his novel Pity, as he mentions in this episode, comes out later this week, so get ordering slash get down to your local bookshop, or if you live in the UK, get to one of the book events that Andrew is going to be doing around the country. That aside, what else has been happening? Ben's got loads of gigs coming up in February. If you're anywhere in the UK, check out his Instagram at Vanderlaugh or his Twitter, same handle there, and you'll be able to find him in a comedy club near you. And as for me, if you liked our episode with the brilliant Chris Grace, American comedian, improviser, star of the TV show Superstore, he started doing some streams of the social deduction game Blood on the Clock Tower, which have been a whole lot of fun. He's got a YouTube channel, which is called Noobs on the Goof Tower. And I had the pleasure of playing a couple of games with them Wednesday last week at time of release of this, so if you want to go check me out playing on there, go find Noobs on the Goof Tower on YouTube and give Chris a bit of support. There's various other past guests of the show doing all sorts of brilliant things with the new year ebbing into its second month already, so if you're working your way through the back catalogue, as I know a lot of people are doing, then why don't you go and give a Google to each guest as you listen to them and see what they're up to these days. It's one of the pleasures of doing the podcast is that we get to introduce new people to other new people. And if you're looking to introduce new people to a new podcast, well, why don't you recommend them to ours? Worst Foot Forward is on all of the social media that you could care to think of, at Worst Foot being our handle. Our website is worstfootforwardpodcast.com. And, you know the deal. What things help sell podcasts, what help us get in front of new people is writing reviews, leaving us 5-star comments, recommending us to friends, hitting the subscribe button. All of those things really help out. And if you're in a monetary position to help us out, well, you know the deal as well. It's Patreon, guys. If you listen to a podcast, you probably know what Patreon is. It's a way of donating either at monthly or yearly or one-off intervals to your favourite creators. So head to patreon.com/worstfootforward if you want to donate to Ben and myself and help us keep making episode after episode. We have all sorts of guests and plans for the year ahead, a couple more live streams and live shows, hopefully. And we love doing this and we like to keep doing it. And so if you're in the position to offer us some support, head to Patreon, as I said, and you get some bonus content, bonus interviews with guests, other bits and pieces, videos of the live shows, and so on and so forth. We appreciate all of you if you're a donor, if you're not, if you're a listener, if this is your first time, welcome. If it's your first time, you've not even heard one of our episodes yet, what am I doing holding you up? Please let me get out of your way and let you enjoy this episode with our guest, Andrew McMillan, all about the world's worst exercises.
Welcome, gym bunnies, workout badgers and sauna ferrets, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and it's time to get physical. We chatted to our own Worst Foot Forward personal trainer this week, and he recommended that the quickest way to get fit was to pump some iron. I'll level with you, listeners. I've been working away with this Russell Hobbs Steam-O-Matic 3000 for half an hour with a bike pump, and I haven't been able to inflate it one bit, but I do seem to have worked up quite a sweat, so we might be onto something. For motivation, he wrote the words, "No pain, no gain," on a mirror in front of me, so I've been exercising while listening to Nigel Farage sings the best of Chris the Berg. I've not felt the benefits yet, but we'll get there soon. And for my warm down, he recommended some stretches, so I've done a little bit of yoga. Unfortunately, my PT was influenced by some of the problematic yogis of the 1960s, so the main positions that I've done are down dog, no really, get down dog, bad dog, down, back down, sit, back in your basket, and no, think what you've done. And now, with my exercise regimen over, it's time to introduce you to my training buddy. The squat to my thrust, the heave to my hoe, and the clean to my jerk. It's Barry McStay.
I was a member of a gym for exactly 1 month back in 2011. And I joined it because I was going to be in a play where I was topless for the entire time on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only time I've ever done it. And my abiding memory of it was being like that meme of Tamsin Gregg from Black Books, where she goes to her first day at work and doesn't know what anyone in the office does, and she's just like flailing her fingers on the keyboard. All of the material and the machines around me just made me feel completely overwhelmed.
Oh, absolutely. It's so much. I've definitely joined more gyms than I've visited, I think.
You and I both prefer running and swimming to being in gyms, I think.
Yeah, it do. Well, I'm saying this on the podcast for accountability. Before I had children, I enjoyed doing half marathons. Not many, but enjoyed them. But next
he was
year,
meant to be doing full marathons. He always kept stopping halfway through.
Yeah. I'd get to the interval and I'd have a couple of ice creams. I'd be like, well, this is lovely. Let's just sit and read the program.
Oh, imagine if Olympic sports had intervals. Much more of them should have it. Absolutely. Halfway through, rotating in the circle for the hammer throw, you just take a break.
Yeah.
Everyone goes, how do we think about that wind up before the release? What do we think is going to happen?
Well, I took my son to his first non-league football match at the weekend, and I realized, like, it's called half time. It's not an interval, mate. You'll get a start. Next year, me and one of my best mates are going to do the Great North Run at the age of 42, dressed as Arthur Dent from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
How lovely.
I know that lifting weights is good for you. And I remember, God almighty, I remember after my 30-something birthday, I stupidly said yes to a free personal training session from a mate of mine. And I cannot tell you how hungover I was or what repulsive chemicals must have been emanating from all of my pores as I sweated and cried through an hour of it.
Yeah, I know what friend you're talking about. That is, I think PT, because my husband uses a PT because he's bougie. And the only thing I know about PTs is that he'll come home and then spend the next 24 hours complaining about how sore he is.
I'd want a PT who's in that sweet spot of encouraging and nice, so they'll make you do the horrible stuff and don't mind you releasing a barrage of swear words at them. Also,
yeah,
if I won the lottery, I would pay extra to have a PT who was dressed in a full Ringmaster's outfit, and I could call them PT Barnum. And every time they try to get me to do extra squat thrust, I'd be like, piss off, you're so problematic.
You're hardly the greatest show on earth, though, are you? let's get down to introducing our guest. Our guest this week is a prolific poet, playwright and professor from Barnsley in South Yorkshire. He has the benefit of a poet for a father, which presumably would have led to deep arguments should the younger ever have brought up the idea of going into a frivolous career like law or banking, rather than getting a sensible job and carrying on the family poetry business. His debut novel, Pity, a gay love story set in his hometown, is published by Canongate and hit shelves literally this week. And meanwhile, his work as a poet is among the most celebrated queer poetry of the last decade. His debut collection, Physical, is the only poetry collection to win the Guardian First Book Award, among many others. And in 2019, he was voted one of the top 25 poetry books of the past quarter century by the Booksellers Association. The only consolation for not winning the tons of other awards he was shortlisted for, including the Costa Poetry Award, Sunday Times Young Writer of the Year, and the Dylan Thomas Prize, was that he hadn't yet finished building his trophy cabinet. Hopefully, he had done so by the time his second collection, Playtime, was published in 2018 and won the inaugural Polari Prize, as well as the acclaim of no lesser light than Alan Bennett, who wrote in his diaries of our guest's poems, I wish I had written or had the courage to write, particularly the failed encounters. Now, I won't do the voice, but if Alan Bennett is proud of your poem about your first ever wank, you're doing something wrong. He's published a third poetry collection, Pandemonium, as well as a stage adaptation of Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray, where Dorian hires a PT, and co-edited the anthology 100 Queer Poems. As professor of contemporary writing at the Manchester Writing School at Manchester Metropolitan University, he has one of the longest titles afforded to any of our guests. And with his fellowship of the Royal Society of Literature, he's certainly one of the most acclaimed in his field. Not bad for a lad from Barnsley writing poems about sex in dusty lofts and lusting over guys in the gym. Top marks and tops off to Andrew McMillan.
I don't think the loft was that dusty.
I think the space heater you mentioned in it is quite dusty.
That's true. Well done. Yes. That's a good memory. The yes. weird thing about that Alan Bennett thing, when the third... So we mentioned that second book, which was really sweet. And then the third book, when it came out, I was in his diary again.
Hmm.
Like in, and they publish his diary like in the LRB and stuff. And it just, the entry was just something like January the 7th. Got asked if I would interview Andrew McMillan, but I didn't want to. And then he just like moves on to something else. And that's kind of like, so I'm immortalized in his diary.
That's so good.
Twice.
Tell us about your first novel. Because that's, you know, poems are easy, aren't they? Only a page.
Poems are easy. They don't take any time at all. They're just like a little thing. And I mean, the novel's very short. We say novel. It's more like a, it's like a novella. I don't know. It's 33,000 words. So it's very thin. It's very short. But I just wanted to write one for years and tried and tried. And just a couple of years ago, I thought, well, why not? You know, I'll always have poetry. I'll always be able to go back to poetry. I just wanted to be able to try something else and just see if I could do it. And I was really keen, I think, to set it in Barnsley to show that these kind of novels and these kind of stories can be set there, mm-hmm. which is what I've always been keen for my poetry as well. They don't have to be London. It don't have to be a big city. These kind of queer stories can both happen there. And just to tell the story of that town is what I was really keen to do.
That's, yeah, very sad. By the way, listeners in America who are baffled by Andrew's accent, this podcast doesn't come with subtitles. So tune in now.
How rude.
Yeah.
But listeners in America, if you have America, it's like the equivalent of like certain parts of Appalachia is the thing. So when you think somewhere like Barnsley, you kind of think about, yeah, like certain places in kind of Appalachia, I guess. Mm. But in America, my accent often reads Australian. Yeah. Is what I'm often mistaken for. But no, I can try and do my best RP if you want.
Yeah, please don't.
No, please don't.
that would go so against your entire persona.
Yeah, and I mean...
It's purely just a persona. That would be my natural voice.
Yes.
In America, they basically think we only have three accents, RP, Scouse, and Irish.
Also chirpy Cockney.
Yes, no, that is very
yeah,
fair.
Yeah, kind of Dick Van Dyke style.
Yeah, Dick Van Dyke Cockney.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the confusing thing, well, they probably don't register it in America, but the thing I love about your part of the world, Andrew, is that you can go 5 miles in any direction and they've jiggled round the vowel sounds to something completely impenetrable to someone down the road.
Because I'm a professor of contemporary writing, the posh name for it is isogloss, where... As you say, like imperceptibly, just kind of village to village, the accent kind of shifts or changes or pronunciation kind of moves, which is different to kind of the South, where it's kind of much more kind of estuary English. Mm. But yeah, so big, you know, Barnes, and we had this because we're doing an audiobook of the novel as well that I'm not reading, so I can't do like characters and I'd forget what people sounded like. But when we were talking to this really great young actor who we've got for the audiobook, who is from Yorkshire, but kind of not from the same part of Yorkshire that I'm from, one of the big conversations was about the kind of accent of it, of kind of like, so what do the vowels sound like? What would they sound like? But then also like generationally, right? Because my dad, who you mentioned, kind of, he sounds different to me and he sounds different to my granddad. And so accents also shift kind of generationally.
Yeah.
And mine is now because I've lived in Manchester for a long time, lived in Liverpool for a bit. Mine's just kind of much more now like generic Northern. Like I could play a northerner in like a political drama.
Yes.
Because it's just kind of like generically northern.
Speaking of someone from Newcastle, you're not. You're generically southern. But there is, I mean, I want to say the whole thing about, you know, isogloss and the variety of accents being a much more common phenomenon up north than it is down south. Is that because northerners are just inherently more interesting than people from the south?
Stop trying to get me cancelled this early on in a book tour.
Well swerved.
What I think, the really dull answer, I think, is that it's somehow to do with industry. So it's about how heavy industry in the north, it was often kind of based around particular towns. And so you'd have particular kind of industries that were there that would kind of develop their own kind of sociolects or idiolects, which is why also kind of in the southeast or kind of Cornwall and places like that, or kind of Welsh valleys that were also kind of heavily industrialized with particular industries, you had that kind of shift from town to town, because say like Barnsley was coal mining but Sheffield was steel, and so you have kind of industries very close to each other that are different, that are kind of built around it. And same in northeast, right? Same in Newcastle and Durham and places like that. So it's something to do with that, as well as the obvious and inherent superiority of the northern people.
Good, there we go. Yeah, absolutely that. And I'm just trying to wonder what it is about heavy industry that gives you such flavour to your accent, whereas working in, I don't know, banking makes your accent deeply beige.
Because you have to shout louder to be heard.
Yes.
over the sounds of machines, isn't it?
Yes, of course.
Since they moved to paper money, the shouting in the banking industry has gone way down.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Andrew, you're obviously very good at glossing your ISOs. What are you not so good at? What are you worst at in the world?
I mean, God, so many things. But what I was thinking is I'm terrible at DIY, anything practical, which maybe is not unusual for a writer, but my ex-partner... Mm. Was kind of brilliant at stuff. And so the house that I still live in now, he sort of laid the floors, he did the tiling, he sort of did kind of woodwork on the walls, he'll be able to put shelves up. And kind of since he moved out and it's just been me, I've been realizing, oh, I can't do anything.
Yeah.
And so I've got a kind of kindly neighbor who'll come round and help me sometimes. But there was one moment when I was kind of putting the house back together post breakup, and there were kind of three different people in the house at one time, because someone was putting the TV up because I can't put the TV up myself.
Right.
Someone was kind of doing something to a radiator because I couldn't do that. Then someone was like changing a light fixture, and they're all in the same room at the same time, and it was just kind of triply emasculating.
Sounds like a Chekhov play nearly, where you're like coming back to the empty house and
exactly, but that's my issue. Like, I think of it as a Chekhov play and not as, you know, I don't think I could learn how to bleed a radiator myself.
Yeah.
I just think of it as a Chekhov play.
I'm with you.
Which
I bet
my downfall.
Those three workmen would love it if you turn them and go, do you know what, lads? This very much reminds me of Chekhov.
Yeah.
They would. And then we could all sit down and talk about that and I'd be much more comfortable.
Yeah.
But no, kind of anything. Like I tried to put some lights up the other day and someone was around at my house and I put them up and they said, right, we're going to go out for tea and we're going to come back and we'll see if they're still up. And of course it collapsed to the floor.
Oh, no.
And just anything like that. Yeah, just I can't, I just don't, I think I don't have the patience, but I just don't also have that any kind of skill. And so flat pack kind of baffles me. I end up kind of in a rage with it and kind of breaking it.
Yeah.
Just anything like that. I think I'd much rather just get a man in, as it were.
Sometimes when you're writing poems, the metaphor is too on the nose to even bother touching.
Well, I think I've probably got that point several times.
Mate,
but yeah, it's much better to get a man in.
I've married my wife for her crockery and her technical competence.
Yeah.
Exactly, which in many ways is the plot of every 19th century novel.
So this week we are talking about the world's worst exercise. So Barry is going to open with his first set of 20.
So I began by looking at various different yogas that incorporate animals, because fuck me, boys, there's loads of them. goat yoga.
Okay.
You said downward dog and you might think some sort of goat might be a pose. No, there's various different places, particularly in America, where you do yoga in a little pen with lots of little baby goats gambling around among you and standing on your back and climbing up and down your legs and things
so
like that.
I thought this was yoga that you did alongside Lionel Messi.
No, the greatest of all time himself.
Yes.
No, you could do it with various different animals. You can also do butterfly yoga in a butterfly house. Llama yoga, bunny yoga, horse yoga, cows, lemur, mini pigs, and cat yoga. The person whose blog I read about the cat yoga said, in my experience, the cats are not terribly engaged with the yoga practitioners. Which yeah. is what you'd imagine cats would do when they saw humans acting like that.
I can't imagine butterfly yoga is very comfortable. Just, you know, as you're, because you've got to do deep breathing, and the last thing I'd want to do is inhale a Red Admiral.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, doesn't it seem dangerous for the butterflies?
Yes.
They'd get crushed under somebody doing some sort of extravagant pose.
You'd imagine so. Or they, like, you know, the natural reaction when something perches on your face or flies by is to sort of bat it away. There is some thinking behind the animal yoga. According to the American Heart Association, if you have a dog, it increases your life expectancy. Now, I don't know if that's literally because you have a dog or if that's because people who have enough money to have a dog and therefore are able to afford better lifestyles. The Minnesota Stroke Institute reports that anyone living with a cat has a 30% lower chance of dying of heart disease. Horses have been used in something called equine therapy to help heal people from trauma. And obviously you've got dogs and various other creatures used as therapy and support animals. So, you know, there is some thinking behind animal yoga, but when you see the long list of animals that have had a yoga built around them, you begin to think, oh, people have just gone through the alphabet and found an animal that nobody's done a yoga with yet and tried to make that their selling point. You could do some sort of workout with half fish, half humans.
Excuse me?
Mermaid swimming is a thing.
No, it's not. Yeah. You can swim with manatees.
Yeah.
not meaning to body shame any mermaids out there, but...
Yeah, no, there is, originating apparently in Australia. I presume you'll have seen those professional, in inverted commas, mermaids who, you know, swim around in tanks with the tail, with their feet in a mermaid tail.
I imagine that is quite a good workout.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah. So it's
like a good, that'd be like a good core workout.
Yeah, it's low impact, low intensity or whatever it is, but it's, you know, you're working your cardiovascular system, your flexibility, your core, as you say. And you can buy different types of mermaid tails. So you get in a pool and you basically do loads of exercise, but you're wearing a mermaid tail. And you can buy various different tails to depending on how much resistance you want or what type of tail, whether you want a silicone one or a fabric one. This article I read said there's various different benefits for the different tails. Silicone tails are very, very popular because they're lightweight and durable, whereas fabric tails are ideal for those who prefer, and I quote, a more realistic mermaid look.
True.
What?
And mermaids are always ripped, right?
Absolutely.
Like mermaids,
yes,
always do look good.
Oh,
right?
Triton, so, absolute daddy. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So clearly it works.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, all those surfer dudes and dudettes from Australia and California, of course they're all ripped. If you had to do a exercise regimen based on any mythological creature, which one would you pick?
I was about to say unicorn because I'd then have a horn to like make sure that everyone else in the class kept a certain distance away from me.
Oh, right.
Always,
I thought you can say
it's always my fear.
Use the horn to swing on.
Yeah, no. It's just, workout class is always like, you know, make me a bit antsy because I always think they happen in rooms that are slightly too small for the size of the group of people that are in them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
So yeah, maintaining my distance with my unicorn horn would be the ideal for me. Andrew.
The Greek myth, and I can't remember his name, but where they're in the labyrinth and he has to walk out and not turn around and trust that he's following her, but he turns around and she turns into a pillar of salt.
Oh yeah,
that's from the Bible.
In the Bible, there we go.
Well, there you go. I was going to say that was the first myth, but again, I'm trying not to get cancelled really early in my book tour. So,
mate, it's fine. On behalf of the Jews, it's definitely made up.
You could do like a. There's a guy in my gym who has a kind of like almost like a weight belt, but one that he wears around his neck so that he can do kind of what I would describe as like neck crunches. And I think if you wore one of those and kept having to turn to either side, you could really just work on the side of your neck.
Yeah.
And that would be my mythological workout program.
Get yourself fit like Lot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I like it. Yeah, I'd probably do leg day with sleep near.
That's such niche references, by the way. This is like niche humor.
Welcome to our 151st most popular comedy podcast in Bolivia.
Yeah.
What else did I read about? Plogging. Plogging's a craze that started in Sweden in 2016. Do you want to have a guess at what?
Plogging?
Yeah, you can probably guess that the ogging bit comes from jogging. So it's jogging and doing something else.
That begins with a pl.
Well, it does in Swedish.
Oh, plogging, not flogging.
Plogging, P-L-O.
Plowing.
Close.
That'd be a good workout.
Yeah, it would actually.
Plowing fields, farmers are always fit.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yes, physically. gosh, I can't think what other
plucking, like you pluck a kind of feathered animal.
That's much, not an animal, but you're plucking, plucka is the Swedish word, plucka up, or picking up. You're picking up rubbish as you jog.
Oh, yeah. But the whole point of jogging is that you get into a rhythm.
The point of this one is that you're working out cardiovascularly in the bits where you're jogging, but then you're also like bending over and you're helping the environment as you go. There's a organization in America called Keep America Beautiful. They really like
I think you've
jogging.
Mixed them up with a eugenicist organization.
Yes, it does have vaguely eugenicist phrase, yeah, sounding Keep America Beautiful. But they run an event called the Trash Dash every year, where they encourage people to go for a jog in their local community and pick up rubbish as they go.
Or is are they running with one of the extendable rubbish picker-uppers?
Oh, picker-uppers. I don't know. Actually, I can imagine them running behind a marathon, where, because you know the way marathons are always like drinking half a bottle of plastic water and then chucking it down. Yeah. So you have a bunch of ploggers running behind a tidying up after the marathon.
Oh, it's lovely. That's like the little birds that live on the top of hippopotamuses or clean alligators' mouths. They're yes, just like the symbiotic athletes.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. A class I would hate to go to is cycle karaoke. I don't know if this has reached the UK, but that's 100% no for me. Crunch Fitness is an American gym franchise, and they do a thing where, you know, it's basically you're cycling, but the instructor plays karaoke tracks while you're cycling.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, it sounds like hell, to be honest. They've got the lyrics on flat screen TVs at the front. Most singing happens during the slow to medium pace songs, obviously. And but they also allow you to call up the location in advance and email a track list to your teacher in advance to say, I want one of these so I can
show
off.
No, that'd just be full of, God love them, the worst people in the world.
100%,
it?
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
it would be full of people who both enjoy that kind of exercise class, but also believe themselves to be very good at karaoke.
100%.
And like that combination of people, like while someone's kind of like showing off on the spin bike whilst belting out Let It Go from Frozen.
Yes.
It's just like the worst kind of combination of person.
The only thing to do is to email in lots of Leonard Cohen songs, and they just made their bed and they have to lie in it.
Yeah, apparently the instructor will stay at the front of the room and motivate you, and then an assistant wanders around with a microphone allowing you to sing a solo if you want to. So it's not just the whole class singing in unison, but they let some people take out. Yeah, it sounds like that is the definition of Sartre's hell as other people, isn't it?
Yeah. Andrew's absolutely right. We need to get those people in the room, start them cycling, start them singing, lock the door, throw away the key.
Yeah. I before I come to my suggestion, I veered into the world of celebrity workout videos. Jane Fonda's workout 1982 video was the first non-theatrical home video to top the video charts, and it was the top-selling VHS tape apparently for 6 years in a row. Like, the impact of that as a like a cultural phenomenon is it's like hard to overstate. And the success of it meant that everybody else, every other celebrity in the 80s who was worth their salt, was churning out workout videos. So you'd Cher with A New Attitude, Mark Wahlberg's with the Marky Mark workout.
Mark Wahlberg was fit, though. Well, still is fit.
Yeah,
but Mark Wahlberg was ripped.
This is when he was Marky Mark. That's a long time ago now. Paula Abdul had one, LaToya Jackson, and even the Golden Girls' Estelle Getty released Amazing. Young at Heart. Which it has one of my favorite opening lines of any video I've ever seen ever, which was, "Congratulations, you figured out how to turn on your VCR. That's the hardest part of this."
Oh, that's amongst the most 1980s lines I've ever heard in my life. All I want to say is, if Paula Abdul's video isn't called "Improve Your Abs with Paula Abdul," then what is the point of anything?
Sadly, it isn't. Estelle Getty then introduces her coach, Raphael, who oddly looks like Darwin Núñez, the Liverpool striker. And he comes in and says, "You're my inspiration." And she says, "Oh, please, I could live inside one of your thighs."
Be great.
She's amazing.
Do you think it would be really good if there'd been some sort of like late 80s, early 90s, like, you know, Jane Fonda, like really good actress, but like Sir Ben Kingsley's workout video.
Yes.
Jessica Tandy. Like, you know, these kind of like icons of stage and screen. Vanessa Redgrave.
Angela Lansbury did one. I'm sure you must have seen it. It goes viral every now and again online.
Sure, I must have seen it. Yeah. We misunderstand each other.
Well, it's become a bit of, yeah, as a homosexual with any sort of engagement on social media. It's occasionally clips of it will go viral because it's Angela Lansbury's Positive Moves, a personal plan for fitness and well-being at any age. And she's doing sort of a very gentle workout for, she's nearly 60, I think, at this point. She also talks about sex positivity in it. So there's a bit where, like, Angela Lansbury from, at the time, Murder, She Wrote, pre-Mrs. Potts Angela Lansbury, is, like, soaping herself down in very soft focus, like, quite sexy saxophone soundtrack
what?
Clips. Yeah, because she's talking about, you know, obviously workout's important, but also sexual health is important for seniors as well. But it's just quite like jarring with how your image of Angela Lansbury is.
Yeah,
normally.
This really sounds like you've made it up.
I know, yeah. It really does.
I'm not going to lie, this just sounds like a fever dream.
I promise you.
I'm never going to watch Beauty and the Beast in the same way again.
No.
And I'm just going to throw this out to you. It cannot exist. It won't exist. The only way it can exist is via very sophisticated AI. But I put it to you, the best of these would be a Patricia Routledge workout video.
Oh my God, yes,
100%. In character as Hyacinth Bouquet.
Yes, oh, can you imagine? Well, there's a couple of others that I did want to chuck out. Richard Simmons, famous workout guru, obviously, but he did a video aimed at seniors, and he had he appeared in it with what he called the Silver Foxes, who are celebrity parents. So rather than celebrities, he got, you know, Sylvester Stallone and Farrah Fawcett's mothers and Dustin Hoffman and Al Pacino's dads to work out with him. And in a similar vein, Milton Berle, who, Ben, I'm sure you'll have heard of, famed American comedian, who was in his 80s at the time, he did a workout video where he was basically wisecracking at elderly people who were working out around him.
Tremendous.
So, like, yeah, so going up to one guy that were doing an exercise where they're lifting water bottles as sort of a light weights workout. He went up to some guy and said, "They haven't given you any bottles. Is that because you can't hold your water?" And he's dressed in a wig and lycra. And my favorite thing about Milton Berle's sidetrack is, you know what he's most famous for?
Having an abnormally large penis.
Yeah.
It's got so many things to Google when we stop this
podcast. I know, I'm so sorry.
Maybe I'll wait till I get home and not on the university intranet.
Yeah, but... probably not. Yeah, well, he was like one of the first American TV stars, and it was called Uncle Milty. Like, he was beloved, but also famous for having an enormous penis, and had the misfortune of dying on the same day as Dudley Moore and Billy Wilder, two people who were slightly more famous for comedy than him, so his death got buried a little bit.
Oh, no. I just love the thought of that video, because he famously, like, him and Groucho are two of the most famous cigar wielders in American television history. So I love the idea of him wandering around this aerobics video with a cigar.
Yes, absolutely, 100%. But all of that to aside, I have to tell you about my world's worst exercise. And this is an exercise, well, it's sort of a series of exercises based around a single item, and that is the relaxicizer. If I tell you it was a hit in the 50s, you could probably imagine exactly what it is. It's one of those sort of belts where you stick lots of electrodes to you, and it electrocutes you fit while you just lie on your sofa, according to the marketing. It had the fortune of being endorsed by Doris Day. It was invented by an engineer called William J. Browner. And yeah, it was a hit in the 50s and 60s, sold over 400,000 items at between $100 and $400 each. And it was praised by The New Yorker as the first portable reducing machine in the world. They said it was going to make calisthenics obsolete. Like I said, you just place these electrodes on your body to what they called problem areas. And you turned on the machine for 30 to 60 minutes, or... worryingly 10 minutes for the face, and
love a face workout.
And if you attached more than one pad to the body, there was a little electrical circuit between the two pads, and you could control the intensity with a little dial, and it jolted you fit was the supposed benefit. Except it wasn't beneficial in any way, shape or form, because you're just making your muscles contract at a very rapid, irregular pace without it being controlled by your body and your nervous system. So it things like protective things like pain and fatigue wouldn't naturally set in. They'd kind of be overridden, so your body wouldn't know that it was hurting itself or damaging itself in the same way. So you had all sorts of horrendous things happening, like atrial fibrillations, and one young woman suffering a miscarriage. It was banned. This judge William Gray banned it because he said it was capable of causing ruptured blood vessels, hernias, cramps, vomiting, urinary discharge, anxiety, skin rashes, paralysis, numbness, nervousness, difficulty swallowing, miscarriage, and loss of consciousness. Also said it could worsen pre-existing conditions like epilepsy. And the judge said that it could exacerbate cancer by flaking off portions of malignant tumours into the lymphatic system or bloodstream. That bit may not be correct, but when my masseur is like, "Oh, if you've had a cancer, I probably don't want to jiggle anywhere near the cancer was," having something electrocuting you near any cancerous spots is probably not a great idea.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah, I appreciate that. The last thing I want to hear from anyone if I was that ill is like, "Time for some jiggling."
Yeah. It also, the device made muscles contract at a rate of 40 contractions a minute, according to this lawsuit in 1970. The manual had directions on it, including things like pads must be saturated for each treatment.
That is it's completely insane.
Yeah.
But those kind of facial things, right? Because my algorithm on Instagram is now constantly trying to sell me like jaw exercises.
Yeah.
Like, they've kind of come back in fashion because of this kind of like hyper masculinity vibe that people are on. This idea that, I mean, it's bullshit, really, right? Mm-hmm. But this idea that you can reshape your jaw,
yeah,
through putting something in your mouth and kind of chewing it,
yeah,
or you know, eating as most of us call it, and yes. Yeah, like my Instagram algorithm is just constantly trying to sell me jaw exercises.
Your Instagram algorithm has recognized you as an anxious millennial and gone, relax your jaw, and then taken that to the extreme.
I was just the one with a curiously unshapen jaw.
Yeah.
That it kind of must, you know, fix.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, the last couple of things on this are the relaxicizer, eventually the FDA in America recommended anyone destroy units they have of it. But it came back into the public consciousness because it's sort of a version of it appeared in an episode of Mad Men. Peggy has come up. She's come up with an ad campaign for a fictionalized version of it. But she discovers that the device also works as a masturbatory aid. And so I think, which we've talked about masturbatory aids on the show in the past. But anyone that causes that litany of ailments that the judge listed earlier on, and very much wasn't able to jiggly fit in any way, shape, or form, seems like a bad exercise to me.
Well, so after kind of Barry's, I don't know, zoological kind of tour of different yogas and then the relaxizer, I feel like I've gone for something that's slightly duller. But I was just thinking about kind of what the least favorite thing when I go to the gym to do. And it's the kind of maybe the very humble but kind of very brutal back squat. So where you kind of have the bar kind of placed along your back. So you look slightly like a milkmaid.
Yeah.
I often find myself thinking when I look in the mirror, a kind of humble milkmaid in a Thomas Hardy novel, kind of carrying the pails back from the well or from the milking shed.
Yeah.
And you kind of have it there and you have to then kind of, you know, you load it with weight, come down and push yourself back up. So it sounds on the surface of it, incredibly simple, but it's just brutal. Like, no, the kind of cliches, I guess, that nobody likes leg day, nobody likes doing legs, but it just feels incredibly painful. When it started, so it started towards the beginning of the 20th century, back into the kind of later days of the 19th century, when people would squat originally, they were told to do it with very light weights. They were told that was the best way for it to be an exercise, and that you would do it on your tiptoes with your legs together and kind of almost tilted forward to kind of come down. If you did that with a kind of modern day squat, you'd break your neck very, very quickly. So you just tilt over.
There was a belief,
kind of very, very quickly.
A lot of those early 20th century exercises, they're all to do with shrinking your shadow. So they, they had this, they did lots of stretching and bending and like turning yourself. And it was the belief was that if you made your shadow as small as possible, it was the most effective
exercise.
You
yourself would become small.
Yeah, so like lots of bending over or sort of crossing down over yourself. There was like a brilliant video I found online of a woman doing a sort of reaching across herself and down to the floor. She's dinging a bell on the ground to her other side and or like stretching herself out.
I feel like I feel uncomfortable enough about, like, as a gay person in the gym, like my own masculinity. I think if every time I squatted, I had to ring a bell.
Yeah.
That would just draw too much.
I'm free, Mr.
Kind of
Humphreys.
Welcome attention to me. But no, so it used to be done, as I say, on the tiptoes, which seems now kind of really odd. But maybe you're saying that kind of decrease in the shadow. And then after World War One, it was a German who came over to America after the First World War. And he was the one, Steinborn, who kind of developed this kind of idea of a heavier squat, where you kind of load it and load it and load it up. And so, you know, I had not worked out properly before. And we were talking about PTs earlier. It started for me when I got a PT and just started thinking about kind of weight training and what that really meant. And then I got kind of interested in buying all the kits. I've got the resistance bands. I've got the kind of what my friends call the chunky belt that you have to wear so you kind of don't break your back. And it always just reminds me of kind of in the early days of how to look good naked, when Gok Wan's idea would always be to just put a chunky belt on somebody in order to kind of accentuate the waist, is kind of what I always feel like I'm doing when I kind of strap myself into that in order to do the squats. But no, so that always, if I think about the worst possible exercise, I think it's that, and then all the kind of accessories that go along with it. So the kind of the Bulgarian split squats and then the kind of lunges and everything like that, it just where for days afterwards, if you kind of stretch your leg, it'll feel like it's cramping.
Yeah.
I always think it's awful.
I think that you know, you're always told no pain, no gain and all of that stuff. But some of the exercises where the pain seems to last longer than the gains.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. And I think that, but they do work, I guess, is the thing. Like, and there's just something psychologically nice about having done it. As long as you don't have to in any way walk up any stairs or uphill, as long as you only have to remain on kind of flat ground.
Yeah.
Then I think the kind of endorphin like buzz that you get afterwards kind of makes it worth it. But otherwise, and also I just think being that kind of like, I wear, you know, you've got your short shorts on because you need the kind of, you need your legs to be able to move and to breathe. And then you kind of squat, you're just in a very vulnerable position in case you, I don't know, fart or anything like that, which does happen every so often, just kind of naturally. But it also just feels like an incredibly prone position to be in a kind of room full of strangers.
Yeah.
And when 100%. I had the PT, he would often, obviously, kind of when I was doing heavier weight, kind of spot me. And that's an incredibly kind of intimate thing because he stood behind you kind of and not touching the bar, but kind of goes down in kind of sync with you as though it's a kind of choreographed dance move and then kind of rises back up with you. And you're not, your bodies aren't touching, but they almost are.
Yeah.
It's incredibly kind of intimate space to occupy with somebody, I think, who isn't a partner or who isn't kind of otherwise very close to you.
Yeah. I suppose if anyone's not read Andrew's poetry, yeah, gyms and workouts and things like that feature quite a lot in them. And I suppose...
Obsessed by, like, you know... By masculinity, very broadly, I think, is what I'm really interested in writing about. And like, if you want to know what's gone wrong in men in the kind of last 10 years, then you just go and watch straight men attempt to talk to each other in a gym and the kind of awkward ballet that kind of entails. And yet on the other side of that, it is this incredibly intimate space, this space of quite intimate touch. And the really weird thing about gyms, the really weird thing about that kind of space is that, particularly with the rise of like Instagram and stuff like that, is these guys who are wanting to make themselves straight men who want to make themselves physically attractive to other straight men.
Yes.
and that's what the algorithm is. If they're posting their kind of workout videos, they're posting themselves topless. As a gay man, that might be what we call a thirst trap sometimes. Or that might be because you want a certain kind of attention. For straight men, it's because they want other straight men to say, hey, your quads look really good today.
Yeah.
And they need that kind of endorphin kick. And it's this incredibly strange thing because these spaces still feel hyper masculine. I felt terrified the first time that I walked into a kind of free weights area of a gym. And yet in that hyper masculine space, you have something that is incredibly homoerotic, as I say, which is these men just wanting the validation of other men.
Yeah. I always think your writings about them are very, they're like tiny sad epics. Sometimes like that.
In many ways, it's what every gym session is, right? Like,
exactly.
Like a tiny sad epic every morning in the gym.
Yeah. Well, they like, you know, gymnos is a Greek word meaning literally naked. But it does have like that Greek, you can imagine like Greek.
I don't do it naked. It's
no, obviously not. Not, well, maybe not. Maybe they're different. You're very hardy up in Barnsley.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say gymnos is a Greek word that means low self worth.
No. but yeah, there, you can imagine sort of Greek heroes and soldiers from the Peloponnesian Wars working out as the settings for all of these. But then there's all these like, there's like the vulnerabilities and the misplaced lust and
I mean,
all the things
that goes
with it.
I find fascinating that in many ways, like we've constructed these things. Like there's no reason why, like nobody in my life as a poet or in this office at like university is ever going to come in and suddenly say, hey, listen, we need someone to put 150 kilograms on their back and bend down really slowly, then stand back up. Otherwise the building will collapse. Like that's never going to become an issue. And yes, I did sneak in the fact that I can do 150, but like, that's never going to become an issue. That's never going to come up. And so in many ways, the kind of thing, you know, you're never going to have to push weight off you in that way unless the kind of building collapses on you. Like these are kind of pointless things in some way, right? Mark Doty, who's another great American poet who I love, has this great phrase in a poem where he says, lift nothing that needed to be lifted, which is somehow kind of the point of it. And it just struck me when you're talking about war, it's like how we've replicated these kind of theaters of space that will kind of never be in, like Tough Mudder is a really interesting example of this, when they get people to kind of run through electrocuted fences and you have to go in the mud and stuff like that. It's this kind of recreation of something that we as a generation will hopefully kind of never have to be mass mobilized into. Mm. And so these kind of weird kind of spaces that we construct for ourselves where we go, well, no, you know, I might never be sent off to war, but hey, look, I can push this, I can lift this. Yeah. And it's kind of somehow a replacement of that as well, I think, of that kind of ancient Greek theatre, maybe.
Yeah.
I was just thinking this because I saw a Daily Telegraph article, never a great basis for sanity, but when there was the news about the Chief of Defence going and the Defence Minister going, we're no longer in a post-war world, we're in a pre-war world, and the Telegraph were immediately getting a hard-on so they could cosplay what World War III would look like with a picture of the Houses of Parliament and Chinooks and sandbags and like this. It's remarkable that people could do this and the right-ish side won, but also stop fetishizing warriors and start fetishizing poets, I guess.
Like, here, here. Yeah. I would like, from this day forward, to fetishize much more. But also the weird thing, because I did read that Daily Telegraph article as well, that on some level, like just philosophically, aren't we always both in a post and pre-war world?
Yes. Yes.
At any point of history, we've always been both post and pre-war.
That is not the level of linguistic granular criticism that the Telegraph needs or wants. But yes, I agree.
They did call me ultra woke the other week as well, which was fun. The Daily Telegraph.
Well, I mean, you're not a heterosexual. I think that's as far. Yeah, that's as
they
far as you need to go.
Ultra woke author who's doing a book launch with a drag queen, all of which are true things.
Yes. What a crime against humanity.
What a crime against humanity. But no, and like, I just think the gym is that space where, like, I go very early in the morning, so I go about like 5 because it's always quiet. I don't like it when it's busy. Mm. But there's something about, you know, as awful as that kind of squat is or the kind of deadlift, it's just a kind of mind-emptying experience as well. Like, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to you guys. I listen to kind of news podcasts and things like that. And it's just a kind of, it's an hour or an hour and a half where there's no emails and there's no kind of other pull on your time other than the kind of, like, the reason I kind of never really get into yoga is because I can't empty my mind.
Yeah,
like, I can't overthink it enough, and especially if those kind of horses that were going to kick me in the face or whatever it was that you were kind of describing to us, you'd be permanently on edge, wouldn't you? You can't do yoga with horses. You'd never be able to relax.
Horses would work much better in the gym because, you know, how they count by tapping their hooves on the ground, like, one and two.
A horse personal trainer would be an amazing sitcom.
Yes. I don't know, because I'm
kind of pitch, right?
I think, you know, horses are notoriously skittish creatures, as are you, Andrew. I don't think you'd get on at all well as Pete, as PT and client.
I mean,
client.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
But I just think, like, you know, there's something about the only thing that matters, like, when you're doing a squat, is like I've got to get this back up. Otherwise, it will genuinely crush me.
Yes.
Or I'm just kind of stuck here. Like, there's no alternative. If no one's spotting you behind you, like, the only alternative, because the way of getting out of a squat is incredibly complicated, because you have, if you can't lift it back up, you have to kind of like frog jump out from under it whilst you have to jump forward and throw it back at the same time, which it just becomes quite a difficult kind of maneuver to do. And so the only way out of it is to push it back up. Otherwise, it will crush you. And there's something kind of mindless about that.
Yeah.
There's no way of reasoning yourself. There's no poem that could reason your way out of it. Or there's no kind of poetic solution to it. It's just kind of something about force. That's what I really like. The horse personal, I just think this is a really good pitch.
Yeah.
The horse PT. And it's kind of like BoJack Horseman style. Like, it's a kind of satirical comedy.
Yeah.
But it's also about kind of body image issues, because the horse, like, they're all kind of like injecting themselves with, like, you know, kind of things,
hormones,
in order to get bigger and things like that. And I think this could really work.
They're in the racing industry. They're all
in
looking
the racing
for those
industry.
Gains.
Of course they are.
Yeah.
But he's also a PT. Amazing.
There is coming from a horsey family, there is a horse exerciser machine, because, you know, you exercise horses by basically walking them around in rings. And then they got tired of people having to do that with them on a rein, so they've invented like a horse treadmill thing, which is a large ring you would walk a horse around in, but it's basically like a slot, like one of those revolving doors in an office building. So it's got compartments, maybe 3 or 4, and you put a horse in each of the compartments, and then you turn the machine on, and basically the thing starts rotating and the horse just has to walk and keep walking. So treadmills
almost
for horses,
like that thing that's the first ever moving image.
Yes, a bit like that
horse
thing. Yes,
like
yeah.
Wow,
we already have the first item of them in the horse gym.
The horse gym.
Maybe they're bench pressing jockeys.
No, it's not a gym for horses. Listen, it's not a gym for horses. It's a human gym.
Sorry, yes.
Where the horse is the personal trainer.
so sorry. Does that, to drill down into the narrative slightly, is this a world in which talking horses are completely a normal thing, or is this one horse that nobody seems to recognize as a horse who is just trying to fit in?
I think, yeah, it's like a horse, but he's dressed in like Gymshark, so everyone just thinks he's on steroids.
Yeah. And then the climactic episode, he breaks his leg.
Oh, God. And you just hear the click of a shotgun and fade to black.
Fade to black.
And the horse would be played by Judi Dench.
Yeah. Yeah.
With Barry, you already touched on yoga with non-human participants, but there is a particular type of yoga which does have human participants that really rankles with me. In promoting my comedy clubs, I joined all sorts of different groups on Meetup to try and attract them to my nights, and there is one group that I regret ever joining, and that is the group for laughter yoga. It's known as Hasya Yoga, and it is basically where you get together with a group of people and you involuntarily laugh whilst making eye contact with other people. And as well as apparently working your abs a bit, it improves your mood and your brain chemistry and fights off depression, and it is horrific bullshit of the worst kind, and I will not have it.
I would argue if you've signed up to a class called Laughter Yoga, that is voluntary laughter.
I would love it if you came in there as an absolute buzzkill. Like half the class laughs because that's a very funny thing to say in that environment. You're like, aha, got you. And the other side is like, no. And you're like, okay, you need to do more laughter yoga.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard of laughter yoga before, but I mean, it just sort of seems...
Yeah, just someone warm him up at the
yeah, end. Yes, I was going to say...
But yeah, like, does someone, like, say something funny at first?
Yeah.
And then the laughter ripples out? Or does everyone just, like, sit around and wait for the first person to laugh?
No, see, that would be more organic, wouldn't it? You know, when there's, like, weird, awkward silence and you start a giggle. No, apparently it's that you start doing fake laughing and then it grows into apparently real laughing or, you know, hysteria. According to one practitioner, the mind does not know that we're faking it. Yes, but the open spot does.
You know, maybe they tried to have like various different stand-ups, do like the karaoke thing we had early on. Maybe they had a stand-up in the room doing stand-up, but obviously different stand-ups appeal to different people. People have different sense of humor. They decided, no, we can't try and just have a gentle ribald time together.
I mean,
what we need is to just pretend we're having a good time and then let it metastasize.
Lads, what we need is laughter yoga with Jerry Sadovitz. Would be absolutely astonishing.
Or maybe they do a Stuart Lee routine where they just start about talking about something really banal and keep repeating it, and eventually it becomes funny.
Yep, that could plausibly. That is, oh God, I mean, laughter yoga with Stuart Lee, I think, might be the most Guardian newspaper thing of all time.
Yes. If you thought Andrew was being, yeah, that would set the Telegraph off.
If you thought I was Guardian newspaper, wait till you hear this. Yeah. No, it's true.
Yes, obviously, I just thought if you were, obviously, you know, when you used to go to the chippy, you'd get it wrapped in newspaper, but you don't get chips wrapped in the Guardian. You get potato dauphinoise.
Yeah.
Anyway. Another thing, I've got a couple of mates who have done some Muay Thai boxing training. Mm. And there was a thing both in there and also in some Filipino martial arts and some Filipino boxers going for this of shin conditioning. And they do shin conditioning by getting bamboo sticks and basically whacking their shins with them, or then getting glass bottles and rolling them up and down their shins. The theory being that, you know, in weightlifting, you are breaking muscle fibers so that it grows back stronger. So mm-hmm. with this, you're doing tiny little abrasions to kickstart your body's system of rebuilding you to like harden your shins and harden your, and they also will, you know, like whack their abs with bamboo sticks, and there is no scientific basis for this, but they bloody love it.
But shin kicking was a really popular sport.
Yes, it was
in the north of England, right? Like where you would sit in the very olden days, you would get a really large barrel and you'd sit at either side of the barrel, and so your legs would kind of and just kick each other until like the other person's shins were kind of bleeding too much and they kind of quit. And that's just what used to pass for entertainment in the north.
Yeah. Was this before or after they put ferrets down their trousers?
This was around the late 2000s.
Yeah.
No, I think it was kind of like, it was relatively recent. Like, this is maybe the 50s. I also once had a PT whose, when I was back in uni, whose idea was that he would just punch me, like punch my abs.
Mm.
And that I didn't have any abs, but that if he just punched my stomach enough and you tensed until you can't tense anymore, that somehow does do something to your abs.
That yeah. is...
Then I remember having to go home and say to my boyfriend, like, what are you doing in the gym? Well, he just punched me a bit, and I think maybe now I'm getting some abs.
I mean, that is absolutely how Harry Houdini died. So, yes.
What, being punched by a personal trainer?
No, well, not quite, but he had a thing that he could take any punch, and he was, you know, he had formidable core, but someone basically... punched him before he was ready.
Well, he died a few days later, and it's not clear if it's connected or not, but yeah.
Well, it was either that or he broke the omerta of the magic circle and their assassins took him out whilst dressed as white rabbits.
Yeah.
But I think the first theory is more correct.
Do you think the magic circle mafia are like, I want you to make Houdini disappear permanently?
No, it's like, I want to make him disappear, but that's just what he'll be expecting.
I want you to saw a woman in half permanently.
Yeah. So, oh yeah, if you really upset them, then you leave half a woman in their bed.
Yeah. Shin kicking. Can you imagine nowadays trying to instigate that as a sport with all of the like regulations you'd have to have?
But then it's like, there's still that village, isn't there, that has that mass brawl about the ball.
Yes, in Scotland, yeah.
On New Year's Day, or on a certain day of the year, that the kind of entire village and all the shops closed because they all get kind of like smashed in, right? But they were holding it in like the entrance to a pub or like a bank.
Yes.
And it just turns into like a mass brawl.
Yes. But
I'm interested in those kind of sports. They're like Muay Thai boxing where they're a release, it's like a release valve of something, isn't it? Mm. It's like a release valve of kind of anger or energy. That kind of doesn't, which sounds like I'm describing the Hunger Games, but that's not kind of what it was, right?
Next, I looked at the Battle of the Systems. So, in the 19th century, various different people from European countries tried to systematize gymnastics and calisthenics. You'll be unsurprised to know a lot of Germans, a lot of Scandinavians, a lot of questionable nationalism. There's a chap called Johann Guts Muth. And he developed all sorts of exercises based on the Greek pentathlon, adding in, on top of the exercises, balancing, bathing, declamation, fasting, manual labour, and focus on self-control. And also, fascinatingly, in the book that he wrote, outlining his philosophy, there is a chapter of it, Ball mit Freistätten oder das englische Basketball, is the first ever description of the strikeout rule in baseball.
Fun. What year was this?
Early 19th century.
Yeah, the baseball is mentioned in Northanger Abbey, the Jane Austen novel.
So oh, really?
Yeah. When I read it at university, I was like, what the hell is this doing in here?
Yeah. I love it. Like a sport version of the Tiffany problem.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we've talked about it in the podcast. But are you aware of the Tiffany problem, Andrew?
The Tiffany problem is that when you hear the name Tiffany, you tend to think of, either the East End of London or American high schools in the 1950s. And so if you called someone Tiffany in a 16th century play, that just would jar. But it's actually a medieval name. So it's that sort of problem of you're correct, but it feels anachronistic is the Tiffany problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Another German chap I want to tell you about is Friedrich Ludwig Jahn. Do you know what this gentleman invented?
Yarn.
Sadly not. He basically invented all modern gymnastic equipment. Parallel bars, rings, high bar, the pommel horse, and the vault horse. And he sort of formalized gymnastics along a militaristic view of fitness. It's sort of unsurprising since he did a lot of his writing during Napoleon's occupation of German states in 1813. And he wrote a lot, was very influential all the way through the era of the 1848 revolutions. And he also created this idea of gymnastic clubs called Turnverein. And they were promoting not just physical culture, but liberal politics and German culture. And there are a lot of German Americans who also took on this idea. And the Turnverein is like a thing in American gymnastics. you'll be unsurprised to know that this gentleman who proposed the idea of national gymnastics and the German spirit was adopted by the Nazis in much the same way that Nietzsche was. Like, sure. not one of the team, but was considered one of the team.
Yeah.
At the other end of this, you have a chap called François Delsarte, a Frenchman who believed that certain exercises contributed more to poise and grace and beauty and health and is much more in our world, gents. And
thank you.
You're welcome. But he coached preachers and painters and singers and composers to help them express emotions with their body. So it sort of starts off on the gymnastic tradition and then wanders very much into the world of theatre and what one of his students, Genevieve Stebbins, developed into a system of harmonic gymnastics. And so it would almost be like going from pose to pose like in yoga, but that you would be sort of doing statue poses or illustrating a poem, various what they're called pantomimes here.
Like playing musical statues. Game where you've got to be really still when someone's walking around and looking in your face. That's the way to do laugh yoga. Have to hold a pose while someone goes really close to you and like looks for any movements, because that's the thing that makes me giggle.
Yes, that. Or saying certain words. Like if I was playing statues, or someone comes up to me, looks me in the eyes and slowly says the word pillow, then I'm done. One last thing before I get to my selection. I don't know about you lads, I bloody love The World's Strongest Man. Absolute televisual gold. Because it's always on in the bit between Christmas and New Year when you are at your physical valley. And you just have these absolute beefcakes lifting cars and spinning stones on their fingers.
Pulling the truck is the iconic thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, the other iconic thing, the thing I love is the Atlas stones, which is a series of spherical stones that they have to lift up and put onto a plinth. And various countries, Iceland, the Faroe Islands, Scotland, have got histories of lifting stones. The most famous of Iceland's stones is the Húsafell stone, and it's triangular. It weighs 410 pounds, and it was said to be created by a local pastor named Snorri Bjornsson, a very funny name, as a door for his sheep and goat pen. And
how strong were his sheep and goats? The hench's sheep and goats and all of Reykjavik.
Yeah, they've been working out with the horse personal trainer.
Yeah.
And people still compete with replicas of them. You've also got the Dritvik stones, which come in four sizes. The Amlui, or weakling, half Dreitinger, half carrier, half Styrka, half strength, or full Styrka, full strength. And then two other ones with great stories. You've got the Judas stone, which earned its name because local farmers repeatedly tried to use it in constructing a wall, only to have it betray them by slipping out of place.
That's amazing.
And you've also got the Legstein stone, which is like a pillar-like stone, and it's used to mark the spot where an unfortunate farmer made a pact with the devil. As the story goes, the lazy farmer wanted a fast track to an easier, more prosperous life, and the devil offered him his dream if he could complete one task, lifting the 485-pound Legstein stone. And obviously, he couldn't, and the devil claimed his soul, but only after being buried underneath that particular plinth.
Oh, wow. And they needed the world's strongest man to release him.
Yes,
they did. I used to love watching that when I was a kid. We'd go down, my grandma lived at the bottom of the street, and we'd go down to my grandma's on a Saturday afternoon for tea, and it would just always be on.
Yes.
And it is like formatively homoerotic.
Yeah.
Same with the early series of like Gladiators, it's right? Or like early seasons of like WWF wrestling and things like that. Like it's just incredibly. I used to be kind of obsessed by it. It's this little kind of fat kid from Barnsley. I just thought it was amazing.
I really like one of the perennial winners of it was called Magnus Magnusson, which was also coincidentally the name of the host of Mastermind at the quiz show at the time. They were not the same person.
No, they will. What you did is you
got confused.
But when you're that age, when I was like, whatever, five, when you hear one person's called Magnus Magnusson, you assume it's the same person. You can't imagine, you can't fathom a world where people have famous people have the same name.
Well, especially not that there are two Magnus Magnussons, but I'm going to reveal to you, it is actually the same Magnus Magnusson, is that you took the mastermind host and then you dipped him in water and he grew to become the world's strongest
man. I thought
you
were going to say, and his father, his son was called Magnus Magnusson Magnusson.
Yeah. Just history is just endlessly recurring and receding Magnus Magnussons.
Magnussons, yes. We're always in a pre-war or post-war world, and we're always in a world of Magnus Magnussons or
it's
Magnus
true.
Magnusson Magnussons.
I am going to tell you about Vigor's Horse Action Saddle. A perfect substitute for the live horse. Promotes good spirits, quickens the circulation, stimulates the liver, reduces corpulence, creates appetite, and cures indigestion and gout. And I'm quoting
to you. It cures gout.
It cures gout, apparently. It has three modes, trot, canter, and gallop. And it sort of looks like someone has made the bastard love child of a saddle and an accordion and put it on a child's cot and then attached stirrups. And
honestly, don't tell the gays about this.
Yeah. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, either that or, you know, horny women. I imagine it would pass the washing machine test easily.
Yeah, Peggy and Mad Men be all over this.
Yes.
A perfect. I have just seen the poster, and the phrase "a perfect substitute for the live horse" is maybe my favourite advertising slogan ever.
Its other name was the Hercules Horse Action Saddle, which I liked. And
that's,
I mean, listen,
so
it's quite a bit of kit. A mahogany frame with four platforms separated by springs, and it was advertised as well with a bone shaker feel. It was sold as a thing for gentlemen, perhaps ladies, of a certain wealth and class in Victorian era to get fit without owning a horse. I
it
just
looks
love
like a
it.
Bellows. It does look like it's got like a bellows that you're. That's, I imagine that's going to rise and fall. Is it steam powered?
Out of shot are several servants with massive bellows pumping up and down.
Yes.
I mean, what I'd most want to see is them all in a row, like in a gymnasium, but with men racing on them as well.
Yes.
Yeah. This really feels like it's the end of the road for, like, our horse personal trainer, doesn't it? This is like when, like when people who work in supermarkets got replaced by automatic checkouts.
Yes.
Like, this is kind of like he's already been replaced by this saddle.
Before cars, this was the thing that sent the horse the way of the horse.
Exactly.
It's very funny, the image of the man who's riding it as well, because he is in full morning wear.
Yes, of course.
As he works out.
Yeah, just like, you know, I love watching old pictures of old football or old rugby where the referee is basically in top hat and tails.
Yeah. I see it's on Baker Street, Vigor & Co. 21 Baker Street. So 100 doors, or 200 doors down from Sherlock Holmes. You can imagine maybe he had one of these.
Well, I don't know. I sort of feel like Holmes is playing the violin whilst Watson is working away on the vigorous horse.
Yeah, I found one with a woman on it.
Oh, have you? Well done.
Personally ordered by HRH, the Princess of Wales.
Can't be true. What, Princess Diana?
It's Her Excellency the Countess of Aberdeen writes that the saddle has given her complete satisfaction.
Well, there's a testimonial for you. So,
this can't be real. It can't be real.
I don't know how efficacious it was, but I saw it. I loved it. It had to be that. Our nominations for the world's worst exercise are Barry's deadly relaxerciser machine, Andrew's brutal back squat, or mine, the future, the past, and the present of exercise, the Hercules horse action saddle. I'll level with you, Andrew. Yours sounds painful and unpleasant, but it doesn't stand a chance against mine and Barry's stupid machines.
I think it's very true.
And also, I'll level with both of you. My original nomination was going to be for the relaxerciser, and when Barry chose it, I had to do a quick scrabble around to see what else I could find. And I love how stupid mine is, but it's not deadly. So, yeah it's the relaxerciser for me. Before we go, it's time for the world's best news of the week. And we go to MIT University, where their electric vehicle team has built a hydrogen-powered electric motorcycle with swappable parts. And they have decided to make it open source electric motorcycle. So if you want to build it, you can build it. They used a frame from a 1999 motorcycle and have sort of built it around that. And it's this incredible modular machine that you can just like pop a bit out, pop one back in. And they're hoping it's going to be very useful both in tackling climate change, but also perhaps in letting people in developing economies get more mobile transport, because they can just log on, if that's possible for them, and start building and improving it. So a lovely bit of happy tech news to start the year.
Do you think we should be more worried about things being powered by hydrogen post-Hindenburg?
Yeah.
Ah, but what you don't realise is that we're also in a pre-Hindenburg world as well.
Of course we are. That's why I felt optimistic.
Yes. Before we go, Andrew, where can our listeners find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Yep, so Pity is coming out on Thursday the 8th of February. So if you check out my Instagram, which is just at Andrew Poetry, all the kind of dates of events that I'm doing are on there. So we're going to be in Edinburgh, London, Margate, Sheffield, Birmingham, Barnsley, Manchester, kind of mainly all over. And so, yeah, so have a look on there, find out the dates when the events are going to be happening, and the book will be for sale from next Thursday in all reputable and disreputable bookshops.
Outstanding. We're off to work on our new invention for children of the Hercules Greyhound action saddle. Until next time, goodbye.